So they activate getting to the heart of what's really going on and then become creative. When they lead others, it's to be self-directed, not good followers.
Yes, and that's really important point you picked up. They lead others to be pattern generators, not pattern followers. So not trying to get you to do what they do, trying to get you to be you. So what is your experience in that way of leading, Zach? You ever been in that kind of place?
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to thank our sponsor for Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. Turns out my son's now a big fan of Guayaki as well. But I don't know if they're going to like this tagline, but here it goes. Guayaki, try this one. Guayaki, not just for dudes over 40. No? All right. Well, we're also glad that Guayaki continues to brew their mate-based goodness through this challenging time. Mate, it turns out, contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. So it gives me the energy I want while also being a healthy choice. We hope you're going to check out this great beverage with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach.
So today, folks, we're going to be covering leadership styles. And I think we've touched on this one a little bit before, but we've never actually taken it head on. So for folks that don't know what the idea of a leadership style is, it's something that's been around the human resources space for quite a long time. But basically, you take a test and out pops a leadership style you most gravitate towards. And this is supposed to help you better understand yourself and give you a set of tools for working with other people whose styles may or may not match your own. But as I think our longtime listeners will begin to notice, this is probably just another way of categorizing and fragmenting people, which is why I assume we're doing it today, Carol.
Yes, I also get upset when I see all these categorizing in all its various forms. But people are pretty easily sucked into it. I think for not a bad reason. It's like they want to understand themselves. But in our culture, we don't educate people about how to do that, how to make sense of who you are and who you are uniquely. So we fall into these one of four types. But I think we're going to play with it a little bit new way today.
So before you get started, Carol, let me give everybody the article here real quick, which you can also find in the show notes. So it's from HBR, and it's called How to Develop Your Leadership Style, Concrete Evidence for a Squishy Challenge by Suzanne J. Peterson, Robin Abramson, and R.K. Stutman. I hope I'm pronouncing all this correctly. The authors propose that their research has revealed that someone's leadership style is a set of behaviors and actions that can be chosen to express status, in a sense. These tend to fall on a spectrum between powerful and or attractive. What they propose is a feedback-driven process whereby leaders are shown shortcomings they have from others and are then put into a process where they, over time, have their behavior changed to better kind of quote-unquote reap professional rewards, as they call it.
Yeah, I know I like to get people becoming really discerning when they listen to any source that comes at them about what paradigm, what worldview, what are people thinking through? And I think it'd be helpful if you gave people your impression of what paradigm is at work here, how you feel about that, and then we'll give them a second opinion that we, of course, think is a better way to develop ourselves and others as leaders than styles. And that reminds people how important discernment capacity is when you take on this kind of work.
So it's interesting. All in all, I think this is still behaviorism kind of 101 for sure, right? It's an arrest disorder paradigm sourced idea at the end of the day. But the goal of their proposition seems to come from an extract value paradigm, where everything on offer here is so ultimately the reader or leader can reap professional rewards, as I said. But let's dig into the process a little bit here. So the process itself seems to come from an arrest disorder mind, where the authors assume that behavior must and can only be changed externally. In the Know Thyself section of the article, they propose listening to the feedback of others to begin to assess oneself on their leadership spectrum. They also propose keeping a list of behaviors in front of yourself in conversations and tracking which set of behaviors you fall into more powerful or attractive.
Right. And I, like you, could get drawn in really quickly to all of the various things they have here, like feedback and the personality assumptions they make. But I decided it might be more interesting to go back to a book I wrote that was designed to counter this tendency to categorize people and leaders. I wrote it in 2014. It's called The Responsible Entrepreneur, and it is about leadership roles that are needed to build culture or community, or in my case, I was speaking from tribes or nations being built. I was carefully and gingerly schooled, or gently would be a better word, schooled by my grandparents who were Mohawk lineage. They were working on me as a next generation beyond my mother. They did not have the blood quantum to be registered, but my grandfather particularly carried the intention to regenerate the tribal values of his ancestors, and as he pointed out, my ancestors. And he was really diligent about bringing them into my life.
Yeah, and that book actually was one of the ways I was first introduced to you. But I remember talking to people who also read the book and thought the roles were actually categories. So can you speak a little bit to the difference between the two?
And of course, we assume everything that has differences must be categories and we must fit in one. Well, so there are two things to watch for here. First, with categories, people try immediately to do as I just said, figure out who they are, what bucket they fit in. Am I this type? Am I that type? And of course, they did try that with my book. But there is no such thing as you being one of a type. We are each unique individuals who must use every one of these archetypal roles that we're going to talk about today to inspire themselves and to be relevant to different situations. But always you bring your own essence to bear, and those are inspirational ideas. They are not synonymous. You are not synonymous with the role or category, and neither are any of the archetypes I give you are not categories. And no one should try and adopt them and learn a style like this article suggests with a list of boxes and characteristics, and then you work on them and practice them, you get better over time. Nope, that's not what we're talking about. Do not put yourself in a category, and do not assume that you should learn them.
Right. So, okay. So let me make sure I'm reflecting this back to you appropriately. So, right. So each person can and should use a chosen role at one moment in time based on what's relevant to the situation. But let's let everyone know who's not read the book that you had four of what you call archetypal roles, right? Let's go through those.
Yes, yes. There are four indigenous roles that the Iroquois use. I've actually put my words on them. Obviously, I don't speak Iroquois or Mohawk, but they are my experience of working with my grandfather to come to understand them and to understand they're all needed. And particularly they were needed to rebuild tribes, rebuild nations that had been scattered. And they were worked on as a part of the potlatch and the annual gatherings. We then learn to switch to a different role as a different need arises, more true to what's going on at that moment in time. If they identified stronger with one role and tried to get better at it, they would have been limiting their ability to take on different challenges. So you want everyone in the tribe to have this emotional and intellectual connection to all four roles. So for example, you start thinking of yourself as a warrior, then you may always think that that's what you do and you're always doing battle.
Got it. So the first point here is to avoid putting yourself into a box as though this is you. Be your own self and use the roles to become more flexible and creative about how to be in a group or organization. And particularly don't label yourself or other people using these. Learn to take them on only as needed. So what are the Iroquois roles to learn and how do we use them effectively in leadership?
All right, so let's start with warriors, since I looked at that one, mentioned it first. So most people think of a warrior as people who go to battle. But in the Iroquois sense, it was seeking to stop themselves from being on automatic. where they would lose connection to reality and to life because they were not fully present in their state of being to what was in front of them right now. Now, when have you heard a warrior described that way? No, you come be very still. And actually, it's not on the Iroquois, even the samurai. Other warriors had this same idea. And in this context, it meant being able to understand something as new, as being able to connect to in the present moment as a subject that we hadn't seen before, to look deeply and ask, what's worth fighting for? My grandfather said that over and over to me. Don't look to have a fight. Ask what's worth fighting for. They do this by revealing what is real in something, what is unique, what is singular, and therefore what is the essence of it. These realizations can then lead us to bringing something into existence that did not exist before, which could be a peace treaty, which could be an innovative product. So the warrior seeks a new understanding of reality by discovering what the essence of things are and then acting to express in a new understanding or that new understanding into existence. They tend to be able to transform how an entire nation, or in the case of many of our listeners, a business, and even an industry, how it thinks about itself and its offerings. Now, warriors can be really tough, and they can be demanding as they're trying to teach people what is it you want to be a warrior for, but I think it's worth the effort.
Got it. So they activate getting to the heart of what's really going on and then become creative. When they lead others, it's to be self-directed, not good followers.
Yes, and that's a really important point you picked up. They lead others to be pattern generators, not pattern followers. So not trying to get you to do what they do, trying to get you to be you. So what is your experience in that way of leading, Zach? You ever been in that kind of place?
I have one here. I think that the headmaster of my boarding school I attended in high school actually embodied a lot of this warrior archetype in how he led us as young men. He was not as focused on our behavior or how we adorned ourselves as much as who we were uniquely becoming. So he took the time to understand each of us and put into place challenges that help us grow and figure out our own way. And when the tough got going with me for academics or sports or my personal life, he would help me to see how each of these things could become opportunities to engage rather than as excuses. He was stern and a disciplinarian, to be sure, but he cared deeply for each of us.
So I'm going to use Steve Jobs here as an example, which may annoy some people. I knew Steve a bit, and I knew a lot of the people who worked for him who came where I was teaching at San Jose State to get a degree in business. Many people actually fail to recognize that what is really the centrality and significance of Jobs' character. For example, in a retrospective piece that I thought was pretty good that Wired magazine observed, you know, Jobs was really a Buddhist. He was a tyrant also. I imagine that Jobs would have responded by saying, it's because I am a Buddhist that I'm a tyrant. He looked at the world from a more Zen perspective, one that's not responsible for other people's reactions. So when he was harsh, he assumed that the other party would take responsibility for using interaction for personal growth, much in the same way you go to boot camp. That was how he was treated by his Buddhist teachers, who confronted him sternly. And what they were doing was seeking to wake him up to the gaps in his own consciousness. So just as a Buddhist teacher expects students to learn to manage their reactions as a part of the work, Jobs held the same view of employees. Now, we could ask whether he was as skillful as his Zen master, and I think we'd probably agree he didn't get there. But until we can see the harshness and the caring is integrated and that they're done with love behind them, I can't believe you can even really understand what Steve Jobs was at his core.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I read that Steve Jobs did not humiliate people in private, right? So for him, every meeting was a full dress parade and every idea was inspected by the commanding officer. It was an occasion to build character, honor success, and reprimand slipshoddiness. Being called to account as a way to educate everyone, in other words. And most of us are not really all that good at this nature of leadership, I think.
No, we're not. And we don't do it from the base of loving something important and believing that people can be self-managing. But let's go to the next role. The clown role is the second archetypal role. And again, remember, these are not types, they're roles. So the clown, and you probably have seen, you saw some of these in school, and they weren't doing it very well. But they actually, when they're on their game, they're seeking to awaken conscience. That means that which allows us to question our own motives, you know, things behind what we're doing and our motivation, and always looking at, are we doing what's really right, even if it goes against the cultural norms. So we seek to connect people when we're a clown to the meaning and the impact of their choices and actions. They reconnect us with conscience. So I think this reconnection happens when we become emotionally engaged and when we can see that we can and in fact must do something because we're part of the problem.
It sounds like the clown is a lot like the court jester who can get the ruler's attention. So they speak truth when others would be sent to the dungeon otherwise. I have known a few clowns who made a difference in this way. And I think some of the best stand-up comedians actually do this really well, like Jon Stewart and Dave Chappelle. Both have ways of using comedy to create insight.
Yeah, Tina Fey, I just thought of too. Yeah, okay, so the clown cares deeply about making it possible, really, to change the social norms. They want us to notice them. They want us to look at the patterns we have that govern behavior. And how are people relating to one another? These norms are meant, I mean, they have good intentions to facilitate kind of like civility of social life. But they become fixed, they become unquestioned, and eventually we become unconscious. So the clown works to awaken consciousness, regardless of what the current norm is. Fact, how does that show up in your life, in your family, or does it?
Yeah, I know for myself, taking on the mantle of the clown has meant that I needed to really see every person, regardless of their level in an organization, first as a person. Right. And that they were someone who had their own unique essence, but had a personality that got in their way just like me. And if I didn't do this, I saw myself falling into more of a manipulator, trying to get them to do what I wanted rather than speaking into something more universal.
Right. And the conscience that could come with it. You know, this is another role that most of us are not very skilled at donning. We can't pick it up and put it on. And that's, as you're hinting at, because we're afraid of being ostracized or rejected, we won't belong. What does it really take to play that role with our children and our teammates and our employees? It's a hard one. So let's go look at the hunter role, which is the third. Now, again, remember, these are not categories. You can't say I'm a clown or I'm a hunter or I'm a warrior or the head man, head woman. They each are roles that are needed if you want a working society. So we tend to be inspired by hunter roles, especially because they want to help us make a connection to some greater whole, not be self-centered. And that means a greater whole with other individuals, but also see ourselves as part of a culture. You know, really examine our belief systems and see how we are part of something else. You know, but without doing this, our sense of reciprocity becomes or remains invisible. I can't see I'm a part of something bigger. I don't examine my beliefs and I tend to split me off and I become a part of something and not see myself in community. It's important to remember, I think, that those kind of split off parts we have about us and them and our group and your group are all illusion. I mean, they're things we make up and then we can see them. We think we can see them. But really, you know, wholes and parts are concepts that human beings use in order to try and understand and even to manage. But the universe doesn't work that way. And our sensory experience, if we really connect with it and are immersive in it, everything is a whole, a seamless whole. And that wholeness and that partness of the thing depends on our ability to think about how separate we are and or how embedded we are in that seamless totality.
So in this context, when we talk about reciprocity, we mean exchanges among entities operating within a larger whole that has the effect of improving the vitality of each participating entity as well as the vitality for the larger whole. And so I think a way of seeing this, in my thinking at least, where I have double standards, right? So for example, there are times that I treat my wife how I would not treat my best friend. And I find myself in conversations with her where she's struggling with something and I find myself telling her what I think she should do. And in a similar conversation with a good friend, I will ask questions and help them to see something they may not see yet or maybe even another path forward. And in this way, I think I lose a sense of the wholeness of my wife and within our family and see what she's struggling with as a separate problem to be solved rather than as an opportunity to share something deeper with her.
You know, this is a perfect time to talk about how you use these. So if you were in that situation and can even half grasp what's going on, and you can ask yourself, wait, this feels like I need to be in a hunter role here. I need to really be expressing myself and exhibiting, just like the hunters of old did, to be feeding and nurturing, ensuring the vitality of the whole, the family as a whole, my wife and even me. And I need to do that mentally and physically, like the older hunters did. You know, the other thing I loved, and this was part of what my grandfather was doing with me, is he was working with the younger, less experienced hunter, me in that case. He was trying to help me lead me on a vision quest. Now, he didn't send me off into anywhere, but if you read my new book, The Regenerative Life, you'll see how he was having me experience things and really be able to feed myself and prepare myself to be able to feed others, to have courage, and to trust myself and members of my tribe and to see myself as a part of that. So hunters are really amazing. Certainly my grandfather was, about being very attuned to a group and noticing anytime, and I can pick this up in a second, when people become greedy, because he can help me see when I wanted something for me. And maybe, just maybe, I was overstepping my place in the tribe. So as a result, he would spend a lot of time teaching and showing me how life fits and things work together between animals and food and markets that were in town at the end of the week. And so every member, including me, could see myself in this whole and contribute to this whole and bring value to the roles that I could play.
And I think that's really motivating to want to be able to do, right? It seems like when operating from that role, I find myself motivated to start from a whole person, a whole organization, a whole system, which I see myself being able to evolve. Like in the case of the world of my business, when seen through the lens of the hunter, I'm called to see our work in the context of how young people make meaning of the world through story. Without that, I end up reducing our work to its functional elements and it kind of everything just drops out. And then it just really becomes about work.
Yeah. You know, I want to tell our listeners a story about Michael Bakker, who's also in the book, The Responsible Entrepreneur. I work with Michael at Google. I met him as he just came over to Google from Starwood Resorts in Europe, where he was responsible for the EMEA group, the food group. He had many, many immigrants who were fleeing oppression, who ended up working in the hotels and the event locations that he had stewardship for. He knew that their second language challenges and them having been driven out with nothing, where many of them had degrees and suddenly were working in food service. So he set up programs to help give them special attention. And he partnered them with natives from the location they were in, who were native speakers, of course, and were leaders. And they worked together side by side. And of course, it improved the language skills, mostly English in the Starwood Resorts. And it gave people a sense of belonging. He also really made sure that no one felt lost, that they felt seen, and they were adopted in some sense, the way he described it, into the Starwood family. he wanted them to experience the reciprocity that existed by being in it so they could experience that and foster that with the people who they were helping take care of. And, you know, I watch Michael now. He still does this in so many ways. Do you have any examples of the hunter?
Yeah, I mean, so when I was in the hospital, we were experiencing the beginning of what we now know as the opioid epidemic, specifically around fentanyl. And for me, I had to face a lot of my own fears and bring my own courage to a seemingly hopeless situation. So I began by convening the heads of local organizations, folks from neighboring communities that were doing their best to address the huge numbers of overdoses that had just begun. And I just started by having them in a conversation, not only to understand one another, but really what was happening on the ground. And long story short, this group ended up creating a series of coalitions to obtain funding to begin educating communities around the overdose crisis, while also creating harm reduction centers and approaches to easing the burden in the healthcare system. But for me, taking on this hunter role was about convening the difficult conversation of bringing together homeless folks and folks in the throes of their addiction and police and firefighters and healthcare workers and local organizations and seeing that something had to be done that I had to uplift, which was the possibility that I could make a difference.
Yeah. I do think that's a good phrase for the hunter, the bringing together and holding a space for difficult conversations. So our fourth role, again, not type, but a role that you can take on, is head man or head woman. The head woman is driven to reimagine the systems and the structures that limit the full potential expression of everyone. They can say, this is not structured right. This system is not working. They also see nothing is fixed and nothing is impossible. For them, everything can be transformed if you find the right place to intervene. So they look for what my grandfather used to call wormholes that bypass the normal constraints of space and time, enable change to occur rapidly. We did this in South Africa, where Stelio Sesos could see that education of all of the citizens of Johannesburg and across the country happening in the same room would bring rapid change. But such people are rare. And when they show up in society, people tend to take them and even sometimes describe them as the era, you know, Stelio Sesos era. As a manifestation of this head woman role, they can rally a nation. They can rally organizations. Certainly Nelson Mandela did that for the whole country. And they live up to some, I don't know, higher expression of something that seems inherently potential. I know this has been a part of what's driven you at Super Alloy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, at Super Alloy, my business partner and I knew, well, we saw in games that combat choreography has always just been done as an afterthought. We saw that it started with taking some cool ideas that animators or game devs have seen elsewhere and then trying to mimic them or kind of put them, like shoehorn them into the game. Instead, we knew that it needed to start with a world and a story and characters all nested together as the foundation of the bodies resonating with the same story that we're moving on screen.
Right. So that was how you went about it. What motivated you to take this on?
When my business partner and I founded the company, it was based on the premise that games, when they're at their best, are well-wrought stories that connect with people fundamentally. In particular, we saw that games seemed to be undermining the growth and development of young men in a lot of ways. And what we saw was not being realized was that our work was to reconnect young men to the first principle of needing to discover something about me or themselves through this process. And as warrior dances have done for millennia, we can see our work as creating opportunities for young people to develop.
Yeah, so I love that. So summarizing, kind of, we have four archetypal roles here, which we need to be able to play all of. It's rare that somewhere in your life you won't need to move. And so I often find even within one day, I can read a situation, I can see what's needed. It calls for spirit, will, ableness, something to be lifted up so people can connect with the community they're in, the organization, tribe, nation. And I move between these roles. We need to all learn to use our own version. I'm not talking about it's described, it's here's how they behave. It's like their inspiration for our essence expression. I know, to me, this seems so different than what was in that HBR article. What do you see as missing?
Yeah, I mean, in our work, we work on non-mechanicalness. In other words, we aim to work on building consciousness rather than building a list of behaviors to follow automatically every time you come into a new situation. Second, we work on external considering or caring. Well, in the article, they're literally trying to put to get people to think only about their own status and success inside an organization. And third, we aim to have folks work to reveal and work from their essence or uniqueness. The authors here certainly can't see leaders doing that, as first they think that personality is immutable, which it isn't, and that changing behaviors is really what matters most.
Yeah, I saw all those too. I also, we've been talking the last two sessions about hidden variables. And I think the whole idea of archetypes is hidden. It's showing the things that can go on, that are going on, rather than this kind of shallow surface-based idea based on personality. I also know from now, having done this for over 40 years, that this way of working is much faster to bring about change rather than trying to get people into their box and learn to play it out. And it can move whole nations. It can move whole regions, like I just said we did in South Africa. And we did it in Europe around creating the European Common Market across 9 countries and 12 languages. And we also did it in Kentucky with Kingsford Charcoal, where 60% of the people in the company couldn't read and write, and their children are following in the same path. And we were able to turn all of that around in a very short period of time and set it up so that actually Kingsford was leading and still is leading their industry. And I have to say one other thing. This also happened in windows of time that sometimes were within a few months, maybe within a few short years, but not in the decades we usually think of change. Plus, the leaders from Kingsford spread out into Clorox and then into other consumer product companies, and were able to take that change far and wide. We have several new learning communities we'd like to invite you to consider. They start in January. There's a community board community that is really for-profit, not-for-profit, hybrid boards of directors, advisory. And if you're on a board, then think about joining us. We also have one that has business teams starting up again, learning a regenerative way to do strategic thinking. It uses living systems thinking as a way to develop strategy, rather than our usual better than last year, what are the competitors doing, what are the trends, or, you know, what would be the sustainable or the circular way. We start in a very different place and end up somewhere else. We also have an ongoing community for educators and for women entrepreneurs. Email me, carol@carolsanford.com, if you want to know more.
Dear listeners, we need your help. Please keep recommending articles on business or business practice, which you want a second opinion. And don't forget, you get a second opinion mug if we take it on. You can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at @biz_second_opinion, or donate to support our production costs on Patreon, which you can find on the Business Second Opinion webpage.
And if you are interested, or your organization is interested in doing a book club around one of my books, I do some of them live, but I have them recorded that we've done with others. And what you do is buy books in bulk through my publisher at a 50% discount. So if that interests you, sign up or send me an email.
And also don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, where you can get connections to the show notes and much more.
And thanks to Numi T and to Babson College, who continue to sponsor the Regenerative Business Summit and Prize annually, although this year we're not doing the prize. They also help sponsor Business Second Opinion website and the show notes that are there.
This has been Business Second Opinion.